I actually want to begin this morning by saying thank you. The last time I was in the pulpit was the Sunday after Chris and Lauren had gone on to the next things in their lives. And in that sermon, I remembered how important all of you are to me and to my life. And I'm so grateful for the grace with which we have moved through this interim time. And we'll welcome our new interim minister in August. In a long list of gratitudes, I would include the poetry of Ross Gay. His voice and spirit fill me with a deep appreciation for ordinary time and the myriad gifts a day brings. He's the author of a book of poems called Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, as well as a book of short essays called The Book of Delights. Don't you want to read them? I commend them to you. Here's a poem, slightly abbreviated because it's very long, and it's from his Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude. Tumbling through the city in my mind without once looking up, the racket in the lugwork probably rehearsing some stupid thing I said or did, some crime or other. The city, they say, is a lonely place. Until, yes, the sound of sweeping. And a woman, yes, with a broom beneath which you are now to the canopy of a fig, its arms pulling the September sun to it. And she has a hose, too, and so works hard rinsing and scrubbing the walk, lest some poor sod slip on the silk of a fig and break his hip. The light catches the veins in her hands. When I ask about the tree, they flutter in the air, and she says, take as much as you can. Help me. So I load my pockets and mouth, and she points to the stepladder against the wall to mean more. But I was without a sack, so my meager plunder would have to suffice. And an old woman now, whom gravity was pulling into the earth, loosed one from a low-slung branch, and its eye wept like hers, which she dabbed with a kerchief as she cleaved the fig with what remained of her teeth. And soon there were 8 or 9 people gathered beneath the tree, looking into it like a constellation, pointing, "Do you see it?" And I am tall, and so good for these things, and a bald man even told me so. When I grabbed 3 or 4 for him, reaching into the giddy throngs of wasps, sugar-stoned, which he only pointed to, smiling and rubbing his stomach. I mean, he was rubbing his stomach. It was hot, his head shone, while he offered recipes to the group, using words which I couldn't understand. And besides, I was a little tipsy on the dance of the velvety heart rolling in my mouth, pulling me down and down into the oldest countries of my body, where I ate my first fig from the hand of a man who escaped his country by swimming through the night. And now a man on his way to work hops twice to reach at last his fig, which he smiles at and calls baby. Come here, baby, he says to the tree, which everyone knows cannot grow this far north, being Mediterranean and favoring the rocky, sun-baked soils of Jordan and Sicily. But no one told the fig tree or the immigrants there is a way the fig tree grows in groves it wants. Yes, I am anthropomorphizing, and I have twice in the last 30 seconds rubbed my sweaty forearm into someone else's sweaty shoulder, gleeful eating out of each other's hands here in Philadelphia, a city like most which has murdered its own people. This is true. But we are feeding each other. From a tree at the corner of Christian and Ninth, strangers maybe never again. I love that poem. It's beautiful, yes? Many of the poems in Gay's catalog of unabashed gratitude tell us in one way or another that an ordinary day is filled with invitations. But we can overlook beauty, walk right past joy, miss communion with our neighbors at every turn if we don't slow down and pay attention. I admire in this poem how time and space seem to open up and out as the speaker, who's been worrying over some stupid thing he said or did, travels an arc that leads from, on this particular morning, self-absorbed fuss to full immersion fig joy. The first thing to penetrate his head-down distraction is the sound of the woman's broom on the pavement. Shh, shh, shh. Then he sees the fig tree, the sun, the woman's hands. Now he's taking her offer of a fig, here, take more, and drawing closer, decides to help her gather them. Never mind the throngs of wasps who love sugar too. And now there are other folks gathering round, not just to share the bounty, but also to share recipes and fragments of story. They are, as he puts it at the end of the poem, feeding each other. I imagine all their smiling lips purpled with juice. When so much comes to us in an ordinary day, information, sensory experiences, interactions, how do we discern what's ours to shape and be shaped by? What practices help us live each day consciously, awake and responsive? Not to everything, which is an impossibility, of course, but to what feels in some sense given for our attention. What I know about poem making is that while a poem has its genesis in experience, it comes to its fullest expression through a process of introspection and association. The poem and I need time for reflection, to remember what I've seen and felt, and to understand how the experience is working in me. By writing multiple versions of what I encounter, I am, along with the poem, being formed. Ross Gay, no doubt, recalled his experience of fig joy, and writing it, saw again his loneliness and his need, heard the broom, the woman's voice, felt the velvety fig she put into his hands, felt again and more deeply the gift of this day's detour and its blessing. But my guess is that it was the second, third, or fourth draft that helped him descend, as he put it, into the oldest countries of his body, to recall his first fig, which came to him from the hand of a man who escaped his country by swimming through the night. Even the fig tree, he realizes, has come from somewhere else, Jordan or Sicily. And the city, too, in which the fig tree now thrives, is made up from people around the world. However many drafts of this poem Ross Gay tried, I'll wager that the real meat of it surfaced in his process of remembering and reflecting, perceiving at last not only the joy of sharing figs on an otherwise ordinary day, but also the triumph of this roadside feast, where everyone and everything had struggled one way or another to survive and thrive. The deepest feelings, says Marianne Moore, another poet from an earlier time, show themselves in silence. I know many of us keep journals, write morning pages, or letters. Letters are a wonderful, wonderful consciousness practice. Some of us write poems, music, because we know the pleasure and surprise of reflecting on our experience this way, how the insights that come in silence can shift our thinking or change our hearts in ways that inform our next way in the world. There are lots of consciousness practices, and some of them are not so quiet as writing. When my daughters were little girls, spending a good part of every day in elementary school, we had a dinnertime practice of what we called snapshots. Over fish sticks, carrots, and celery. I did make fish sticks. I don't even know what they are. Each of us would describe a moment from our day as though it were a photograph. We'd identify the viewpoint, the tension, tell what was in the background, foreground, where there was brightness and shadow. Each of us could tell one or two snapshots from the day. Honestly, the idea was to get the girls to talk about their lives away from home, part the curtain a bit on how they were experiencing the world. I had not had much luck with the question, "How was your day?" It's too big a question for children. It's too big a question for us. Because an ordinary day feels like an infinity, a great kaleidoscope of beauty and boredom, terror and surprise. How was your day? It's a poorly formed question, because what we really want to know is, what mattered to you today? Why? The images the girls described gave us a glimpse of their classrooms, the playground, their friends and enemies. And within the frame of their snapshots, we could see some of what they had experienced, who and what was important to them, where they placed themselves in relationship to others. As image makers and storytellers, they were choosing what we could and couldn't see. And I think this authority delighted them. We asked about how they were feeling in the moment of that stopped action, how they imagined others were feeling. What was happening just outside the frame? Who's not in the scene? Why? Doug and I shared our snapshots too, and the girls asked their own questions, because all our asking is as important as our telling, of course. What I remember is that while different in their particulars, our snapshots and our conversations about them usually had the same sort of story arc as Ross Gay's poem. Thinking we were on one track, we'd find ourselves on another. Focusing on one thing, we'd find ourselves caring about something else. More often than not, the snapshots captured moments when, whether by accident, insight, or grace, something shifted and we were surprised. The real gift of our evening talk, a kind of consciousness practice, was lifting up and holding for a little while what mattered to us, remembering to our hearts what had stopped us, made us laugh, what made us sorry, or what gave us joy. Years later, I perceived in a practice I learned on a retreat a kind of corollary to our family snapshots. Known in the Ignatian tradition as the examen, it's a time of quiet reflection at the end of a day in which we can ask ourselves questions that help us remember what was life-giving or life-draining. What brought a feeling of belonging or of estrangement? This practice, too, slows time for a closer look at what I want to savor or see more clearly, and how I've been shaped by that experience, how I might want to move into the next day differently. The examen is not a process of analysis, but of return, going back over the day in the mind's eye to delight again at the early morning bird song I heard as I sipped my coffee, or to recall the impatience I expressed to a coworker. Funny that I got stuck there, and how I regretted it. The embarrassment I felt when I couldn't remember someone's name, and the sadness then at the hurt in her eyes. Other moments come from my reflection, my fury at a news report I heard on the radio, how sheepish I felt when I avoided a call, how happy I was in the company of a friend I don't see often enough. An ordinary day, in which any one of my experiences can be a stopping place for reflection and care, perhaps as well for the revisions I'd like to make as I look forward to how I'll begin again in the morning. The examine questions, a version of which I've shared with you as an insert in your order of service this morning, are gently inviting. They help me harvest at the end of the day the sweetest fruit, which sometimes comes in the form of gladness, sometimes as sorrow, but always as a kind of spiritual food. In his memoir, Now and Then, there's a lovely passage by Presbyterian minister and writer Frederick Buechner. "Listen to your life," he says. "See it for the fathomless mystery that it is, in the boredom and grief and pain of it, no less than in the sweetness, pleasure, and gladness of it. Smell, taste, touch your way to the holy and hidden heart of it. Life itself is grace." Buddhism invites us to a similar awareness. Buddha is present in all places, all things, all lands, all beings, not just in the monastery. Along with writing, good dinner table conversations, our talks with dear and trusted soul friends, consciousness practices of all kinds help us see more clearly who we are, what matters to us, and why. They help us treasure our lives, as our closing hymn puts it, and they return us nourished, hopeful, more compassionate and clear to the circles of care and purpose that make up our lives. To the new day, ordinary and marvelous, that is awaiting us here, now, full of brightness and shadow, and calling for our loving witness and response. Amen. May it be so. May it always be so.